You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen on Wednesdays after 5 or on alternate Sundays at 12:30. Today, I'm really, really excited to be talking once again to Pam Houston. She's an award-winning author of novels, short stories, essays, and now a full-on memoir. It's even called a memoir, Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. I think Pam is listening, and she chuckled because there's been quite a debate on some of her work about whether it's memoir or auto novel, and so we'll talk about that too. Anyway, Pam is a frequent visitor. She's no stranger to Port Townsend. She's come to the writing conference. She has been a community read author for the Port Townsend Library in 2013, for Contents May Have Shifted. And so 5 years later, or six, she has returned. She returned this winter and agreed to talk to me today. So welcome, Pam. Thank you so much for this interview.
Oh, thank you, Chris, for doing it.
Well, I'd like to start off with just a short reading. I think it gave me a slap in the face about my feelings about the natural world as we live in it today, but also gave me hope. So let's start with that.
Okay. This is from chapter called Mother's Day Storm. Last semester, when I asked my class, as I do each quarter, how many of them had ever spent a night sleeping in the wilderness, the answer was zero. And I realized for the first time in my teaching life, I might be standing in front of a room full of students for whom the words elk or granite or bristlecone pine conjured exactly nothing. I thought about the books that had shaped my sensibility as a young writer. Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Silent Spring, A Sand County Almanac, Refuge, A River Runs Through It, In Patagonia, and Desert Solitaire. Now, amid the most sweeping legislative attack on our environment in history, a colleague worried aloud to me whether it was feasible or even sane anymore to teach books that celebrate nature unironically. This planet hadn't even been mapped properly a couple of hundred years ago, and now none of it, above or below ground, remains unsullied by our need for extraction. As we hurtle toward the cliff, foot heavy on the throttle, to write a poem about the loveliness of a newly leafed out aspen grove, or a hot August wind sweeping across prairie grass, or the smell of the air after a three-day rain in the maple forest might be at best so unconscionably naive and at worst so much part of the problem, we might as well drive a Hummer and start voting Republican. Maybe. But then again, maybe not. Maybe this is the best time there has ever been to write unironic odes to nature. I have spent most of my life outside, but for the last 3 years, I have been walking 5 miles a day, minimum, wherever I am, urban or rural, and can attest to the magnitude of the natural beauty that is left. Beauty worth seeing, worth singing, worth saving, whatever that word can mean right now. There is beauty in a desert, even one that is expanding. There is beauty in the ocean, even one that is on the rise. And even if the jig is up, even if it is really game over, what better time to sing about the earth than when it is critically, even fatally wounded at our hands? Aren't we more complex, more interesting, more multifaceted people if we do? What good has the hollow chuckle ever done anyone? Do we really keep ourselves from being hurt when we sneer instead of sob? If we pretend not to see the tenuous beauty that is still all around us, will it keep our hearts from breaking as we watch another mountain be clear-cut, as we watch North Dakota, beautiful a state as there ever was, be poisoned for all time by hydraulic fracturing? If we abandon all hope right now, does that in some way protect us from some bigger pain later? If we never go for a walk in the beetle-killed forest, if we don't take a swim in the algae-choked ocean, if we lock grandmother in a room for the last 10 years of her life so we can practice and somehow accomplish the survival of her loss in advance, in what ways does that make our lives easier? In what ways does it impoverish us? We are all dying, and because of us, so is the earth. That's the most terrible, the most painful in my entire repertoire of self-torturing thoughts. But it isn't dead yet, and neither are we. Are we going to drop the earth off at the vet, say goodbye at the door, and leave her to die in the hands of strangers? We can decide, even now, not to turn our backs on her in her illness. We can still decide not to let her die alone.
So these two pages really, I don't know, give me pause. And that's kind of weak in terms of the shift it made in the way I think. And so I want to talk about this book. 5 years ago or so, when I last talked to you, you said you were going to go back to the ranch and tell the story of the ranch. And so it's been a while. How difficult was this book for you to write?
It took a long time. And that was partly because I didn't really know how to write a memoir. I thought I did. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I've been writing this autobiographical fiction forever. How different can writing a memoir be? But it turned out it was very different. And when I started, the book was really about the ranch. You know, it was about cutting hay and chopping wood and lambing season and the return of the bluebirds and the Perseid meteor shower. You know, it was really focused on the ranch and very little else. People would say, you're writing a memoir. And I would say, I'm writing a memoir of place. Mm-hmm. And then I turned in the very first version of it. And my editor said, isn't this the book where you really talk about what happened to you as a kid? And my response to her was, God, have I done anything but that? You know, that seems like that's all I've done. And she's like, no, you've never really written right at it. So that part of the book got added. And then, of course, the other thing that happened during the course of me writing the book is that I, like many of us, became just increasingly aware of the climate catastrophe we're in the middle of, and that it's not 2050, like they kept saying. You know, it's not 100 years from now. It's right now. And we see it at the ranch every day. You know, we see the beetle kill, we see the warmer temperatures, we see less snow. Like, we're seeing it year in, year out. And I just thought, you know, so many people are going to suffer in such dramatic ways from mm-hmm. this climate catastrophe. For me to write this ode to my little 120 acres of beauty at 9,000 feet without somehow at least emotionally addressing that would be irresponsible, you know. Mm-hmm. It would mean that I just had my head in the clouds, mm-hmm. literally, at 9,000 feet.
So you stopped speaking around the edges about the traumas of your childhood, and that's interwoven a little bit with, you know, your odes to the ranch and the fact that you feel safe there when there's no one else there. It's still, you know, about your mother, but I've read your books and I wasn't as aware of the impact that your father had on your life and Pam Houston, why you're still standing and able to hike and kayak. So without going into that, you know, it's like your parents were trying to kill you. And reading this book is, you know, it's kind of like, yes, I survived, and the ranch is going to survive, and God damn it, Mother Earth is too, right. Even if we don't. So
that's right.
So
that's exactly right. I mean, those two themes that came late, you know, my childhood and the planet, you know, they met in the middle with the ranch as their common ground. And you know, I came to understand really in the writing, you know, that the way I looked at my life. You know, my father broke my femur when I was 4. I believe he was trying to kill me. And in a certain way, my mom was trying to let him, you know, and so I had to sort of love my damaged self. I had to say, okay, I have taken on damage. You know, I've taken on 16 years of it. And so now I have to find a way to love myself. I mean, that's, you know, spoken like a 57-year-old woman who's had a lot of therapy, but that was the gist of my life, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And likewise, the earth, you know, exactly. Like, the earth has taken on damage, massive damage. And, you know, but it will recover, you know, in some form after we're gone, or most of us, you know, or a lot of us or whatever. And I think while we're here, you know, there's so much to love about the earth, not the least of which is the fact that she can heal herself. Like, we see it constantly. I'm watching it every day out my window. We had the largest fire in southwestern Colorado's history, which came less than a mile to the ranch. And I watched that mountain regenerate, you know, even in the terrible conditions, even in the hot summers, and even in with the lack of rain, I watched that mountain coming back. So she's going to come back, and that is something to be hopeful for. But in the meantime, you know, let's love her.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fire chapter, I thought, was just riveting. I loved the fact that you interspersed it with all the bulletins that kind of go out in fire gobbledygook to people
right. That
are to people that are trying desperately to figure out what is going on.
Right.
I read this chapter, this section, part 3, with Google Maps, because mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out where the fire was. And, you know, I kept, like, expanding to try to find any roads or, you know, where the hell is Red Mountain? And, okay, I got that part. I know, you know, I know where Middle Creek Road is. And also looking at your Facebook photos. So
right.
I wonder if you know that people do that now. I'm sure you do. It's
well, yeah, that's okay. I mean, what I really wanted from that chapter was I wanted to recreate the experience that is anyone's experience when they're going through fire. And that's a lot of us now. You know, if you mm-hmm. think about California, and I mean, really the whole West, you know, the whole West is now living in this fire-prone or post-fire landscape. So, and that's what we do. You know, we have our internet, and our internet tells us, you know, we hit refresh, 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 waiting for the updates of the fire perimeter. And then, as you say, the government hands us a lot of words we don't understand, so we go looking for the meanings of those words. Am I a high-value resource or a low-value resource? And according to who? You know, it's I did, you know, I was adamant. My publisher was like, that fire chapter's too long. You don't need all those interruptions. You don't need all those definitions. And
yes,
I really,
I thought it was great.
You know, I hung on because I know for everyone out here, like, that's going to recreate that feeling of like living and dying by the internet that we all have during
mm-hmm.
the fire.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was riveting and really interesting to read, as was the research that you did on the history of the ranch.
Uh-huh.
The people that had lived there before you, somewhat damaged people. And so that
yeah.
was so that was great too. I love the way that when you read something in your book, you're kind of, you know, you take it in, and then maybe 100 pages later, you kind of go, oh, well, that ties in with this. And
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
why she wrote about that. And at any rate, I also want to talk about the hopefulness and the wonder
mm-hmm.
of your book and how important animals are to you. You don't really have a rancher sensibility about the livestock, do you?
No, I don't. I'm a fake rancher. Though honestly, like, loving my animals and losing them at certain times has made me understand that ranchers, in fact, do love their animals. You know, we since the book was finished, we had a bear attack this last spring, and we lost a bunch of lambs. This isn't in the book. It happened after it. And It was an interesting moment for me, especially like in this political climate, you know, because I'm pro-bear, of course, I'm pro-wolf, I'm pro-predator, you know, it goes with my sense of the world. And I've always heard about those ranchers, you know, up in Yellowstone and whatnot, you know, no bears, no wolves, and shooting wolves on their property and all of that. And then we had this bear literally stalk us. You know, he broke in and we chased him away, and he broke in again, and he broke the door off my barn, and and he killed some animals, and he didn't even eat them. You know, he was just in it for the sport. He wasn't even hungry. And, you know, I had raised those sheep, and I was getting, you know, certain bloodlines that I really loved. And anyway, it made me have empathy for those ranchers. You know, I hadn't thought of them as actually caring about the animals they lost. I had only thought of them as caring about, you know, the money or the profit or the yearly sales or what, you know, I had a mistaken idea of them. And all of a sudden, when I lost my own animals, I thought, well, that would be terrible to lose these animals that you've raised, you know. I mean, it didn't make me want to go kill the bears, you know, not even the fact that my animals got hurt made me want to kill the bears, but it did, like, it moved me to empathy in a time when, you know, that's increasingly difficult. Or, I mean, we're being trained not to have empathy, essentially, by our government.
I look forward to reading about this in High Country News or
or
outside somewhere.
Right.
So the cover is so beautiful. It has a picture of one of your Irish wolfhounds. It has the miniature donkeys on the spine.
Yeah,
and it has,
I
think, is it Roni on the back flap? I don't know. One of your horses.
Yes.
One of your horses.
Roni on the flap. The donkeys on the spine, I thought, was a lovely touch. And then William on the front. Yeah.
So how did this cover come to be? Did you get to design it, or did the, you?
No, it's a wonderful cover designer. And I'm getting so many letters from people through my website saying, I've never heard of you, but I had to put my hands on the cover of your book, you know, which is, of course, what you want. No, it's those are my photos. I took the photo of William on the front, and I took the donkey photo. My husband took the photo of me with Roni, and that was taken on purpose as the book jacket photo. But the other two were just part of probably 200 photos I sent my publisher and said, you know, see what you like. And I didn't see any of the cover until it was finished. And her name, Rachel Willey is her name.
Okay.
And she's a contractor, I believe. She doesn't even work for Norton all the time. But when I saw it, I just thought, you know, yes, like that's, I just love the cover. And it's especially beautiful now because I don't know if you know this, but William recently passed a few weeks ago.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. He lived a good life. You know, he had a wonderful life, and he died in his sleep, which is, you know, more than most of us get. And I didn't have to make the decision. He just laid down and died, and so that was hard, but now the book is a memorial to him because there he is, his handsome self on the cover every day.
And also, all of your Irish wolfhounds. I'll just read a couple sentences, and I think, you know, this is about Fenton, your beloved dog before William, or, you know, they were partners, kind of.
Right.
He preferred to sit nearby, keeping a loving and watchful and ever so slightly skeptical eye, as if humans were always potentially on the verge of making a really bad decision, and he would be ready, in that case, to quietly intervene. Can you tell me how your dogs have intervened in your life of bad decisions?
They're very good at judging people. They're better at me than judging people. In terms of anyone, someone I might have been dating or someone I might have had over to fix the plumbing or whatever, you know, they're really good people barometers. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we all know how dogs intervene. They come over and bump their heads into us if we've been sitting too long working on a paragraph, and they say, let's go hiking. They
they, when we're sad, these wolfhounds are so sensitive. Like, you know, they're very self-contained. They're not the kind of dogs that need a lot of attention. But if I'm sad, one of them will come over and put their chin on my foot, you know?
Yeah.
They would always have me stay at home more, you know, which would probably be good for me. Fenton was particularly critical of the human decisions. So, I mean, sometimes, as I say in the book, like he hated the heat. He couldn't stand it when the house got hot. So he was always very disapproving if we were building a fire in the wood mm-hmm. stove. You know, he liked the house at about 45. That was ideal for him.
So you spent 3 days on the back porch with him when it was time for him to go.
Yes, I did.
That was just incredible. And your friend came, and that was a beautiful part of the story. So there's a lot of things that you've had to survive during your life, and there's more to come, I know, Pam. You wrote a chapter about kindness and gratitude and how people have come to your rescue even though you didn't expect them. Can you expand about this theme a little bit more, gratitude and kindness of people in your life?
Sure. You know, I was born to two people who didn't want me or didn't want children. And, you know, that's a sad thing, but it's not the saddest thing. You know, I work with so many writers who have lived through so much worse than I have. And right from the very beginning, when my mom gave birth to me and she wanted to go to a party, and literally in the hospital, she went to the hospital bulletin board and looked for babysitters, which they have on the hospital bulletin boards. And she called a woman named Martha Washington out of the blue, who came literally to the hospital to be with me so my mother could go to this fancy party before she'd even been released from the hospital. And Martha stayed in my life for 20 years, and she taught me so many things. You know, she taught me how to read. She taught me how to swim. She taught me how to open the door for older people. She taught me how to say thank you and please. You know, she taught me all these things that my parents weren't interested in. But the most important thing Martha taught me was that if you look out in the world for goodness, goodness will come to you. If you look for kindness, kindness is there waiting to offer itself to you. And I've had so many people, like, in spite of my, you know, dangerous, violent, alcoholic childhood, there's, you know, my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Kashner, was always kind of whispering in my ear, you know, you're going to get out of here. You're going to get out of here alive. A guy, Colonel Bob Miller, who was in our neighborhood, who took all the kids camping and made us ride under blankets, and we believed we were headed out west. You know, so much of my life comes out of my experience with him, teaching me to love nature and teaching me the solace and the healing that's possible out there. I mean, again, he wouldn't have used those words, you know, but everywhere I've gone, I've found kindness. And I think even we started talking about, you know, how scared we are about climate change and how scared we are about how divisive our government is trying to make us in these times, and it's us or them, or you're with us or against us, and all that rhetoric. And, you know, I've been out on the road for many weeks with this book now, and I honestly find, yes, I know that's happening. I see it on the news, but the people I'm interacting with in bookstores and cafes and universities and libraries and yesterday at the newspaper here in Spokane, everyone is dying to talk and to be kind and to be generous and to listen. You know, that's the counter, that's the backlash mm-hmm. that's happening to what Trump wants from us. You know, is this, people are upping their kindness game and their generosity game. And I see it. I've seen it everywhere I've been. And it's so important that we do that. You know, Martha taught me that kindness was its own reward. Generosity is its own reward. You know, you're not generous because
you're waiting for someone to be generous to you, although that happens. You're generous because it gives you the endorphins to be generous. It's generous because you're generous because you feel good when you are. And that's the most important thing she taught me, though she taught me almost everything else too.
Yes. So the moments of kindness, the moments of surprise and beauty and being saved by others at times when you're not sure that anybody's coming, from the firefighters to being,
right.
You know, seeing the that hundreds of narwhals in the Arctic, this is really a book to really embrace. So there are many other stories about the wonder of the animals in Pam Houston's life. I'm talking to Pam Houston, and she is the author of Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. It is a mesmerizing read. It has lots of great stories in it. Vintage Pam and more, just really a lot more. So, what now, Pam Houston? People are going to want to come to this ranch after reading the book. They already want to. So, are you going to keep teaching?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Good. You're going
to
keep
teaching. I mean, teaching is so important to me. You know, teaching is really the center of my life. And I teach at UC Davis. I teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts, which is a wonderful community, wonderful voices coming into the world. I run a nonprofit that puts on 6 teaching events a year for non-university affiliated writers called Writing by Writers.
Oh, great.
I do so much teaching, too much teaching, but I love it, and I have a hard time saying no to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so rewarding. I mean, I walked into a bookstore just the other day in Seaside, Oregon, and, you know, I had like 7 students' books in there, like on the shelf, actively right now.
That is a thrill. They're your children. There they are.
Yeah.
They will
and
live.
And so, no, I'm definitely going to keep teaching. I love teaching. I mean, more and more teaching is the most satisfying thing I do.
Okay.
And it's wonderful to see all these books coming into the world. I was Tommy Orange's teacher. I was Therese Myatt's teacher. You know, it's Becky Mandelbaum, who just won the Flannery O'Connor. It's wonderful to see these young writers succeeding because, speaking of hope, you know, there are hope. There are hope.
Okay.
In terms of literature and in terms of the world.
Well, we've been talking to Pam Houston, as I've said before. If you haven't discovered her work, start now. It's time to read. And you could start with Deep Creek, Finding Hope.
Sure.
And then work backwards, or you could start at Cowboys Are My Weakness and work forwards. At any rate, thanks again for being with us today, Pam. And next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. If you got started listening in the middle, you can go to our podcast page on kptz.org. Thank you, Jacob, for engineering today, and Carl Allen is the editor who smooths out all the rough edges. Thank you to all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. See you next time.
Going out west for the mountain breeze. Steel planes are killing me. Where the wilds still roam and the trees grow high. It's a long gone out west blue. Can't you hear that lonesome cry that left my house many days gone by? Oh, my darling's gone, though she did not die. It's a long time.